Good Disruption, a lively discussion between UVA Darden School of Business professors Yael Grushka-Cocaine and Mike Lennox on cutting-edge technologies and practices that are challenging the status quo.
Hey, Mike, how are you today?
Yael, great to see you as always.
I am excited about this episode today, mostly because I know that there is a lot of enthusiasm that you're going to bring to the table, because this is one of your favorite topics to talk about. What are we talking about today, Mike?
We are talking about clean energy. And so this is one where maybe I can claim just a little bit of expertise. At least it's an area that I've done a lot of research and studied. I do have a book. That doesn't still make me an expert necessarily, but I do have some work that I've done in this space. But before we dive into this wonderful topic of clean energy, I did want to, you know, talk about the success we're having, the millions of listeners, of course, that we have. And I was thinking, you know, is it time for us now to have paid sponsorships for our podcast? And Gary, our producer, informed me that that actually isn't allowed in our university setting here. So this is just pie in the sky then. If we did have a paid sponsor for Good Disruption Podcast, who would you want? Who is someone, like a company, that would be exciting to you to be a backer of our podcast?
Ooh, I love that question. Maybe a company of a technology that we haven't introduced yet. So like if I think about the Rivians of the world, the Teslas of the world, companies that we've talked about, OpenAI, none of those actually. As much as I admire them all, we've been talking about them at length, but I want the new and surprising technology. I want the company that we haven't even, the disruptor that we haven't even picked up on ourselves.
So who is that?
New shoe designer that is going to reinvent the way that we think about shoes
we
think about clothing. There's a lot going on actually in the luxury and apparel environment.
Is this AI fashion?
It is AI fashion. One of my closest friends is a designer in one of these companies that is working on both 3D printed garments and just the next evolution of apparel. So
you are very fashionable. I am not. So I could totally use like ChatGPT for fashion. Right?
There you
like
go. Just, there
I
you
could
go.
Ask it, you know, what should I wear today? Yep. And if it could give me the answer, that would be awesome.
Well, fashion is something that you can't necessarily, you know, recreate from historical data. So, you know, maybe this is an area where ChatGPT is going to have to stay on its feet a little
bit. Well, I'm going to question that premise, but you know what? This already sounds like another podcast. So let's go back to the question at hand, which is clean energy.
Yeah, and tell me why you're so passionate about it. Before we dig into your definitions and everything that you're going to kind of help us understand, where does the passion come from? Why are you so excited about it?
Well, I guess, you know, there's been a long-standing passion personally about environmental issues and the interface between markets and the sustainability challenges of mine. This goes back 30 years for me. So I think where we stand today, especially as it relates to climate change, this is mission critical. So just to put some numbers on it, about 25% of our global greenhouse gas emissions comes from the electrical generation sector. And if we look again, we've talked about decarbonization in the past, but if we look at what needs to happen for us to address climate change and try to reduce climate change to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, we're looking at basically decarbonizing the global economy at the very least by 2050, but actually probably even sooner than that, given current trends and trajectories. Electricity is obviously a big contributor, but it's even more important than that because the solution for decarbonization in other sectors, as we've discussed with electric vehicles, transportation, the built environment, is typically to electrify.
Right.
So we are looking to turn more fossil fuel burning sources to electrification, and then we need to decarbonize electrification. Right. So clean energy is at the heart of our decarbonization challenge.
Thank you so much. It's fascinating, and it's so important and so critical to the world that we live in today. And the question of climate change and you know, making for a better future is just on top of mind for so many people around us. But hasn't this disruption already happened? Like the wave of clean energy has been big and been invested in for over a decade or two decades now.
Even further, I would say.
Okay,
but I think You're absolutely correct that I think we are in the midst of a transition, a technology transition.
Right, like 30%, what are we talking about? 30% of the global electricity is basically generated by renewable energy? Is that about
that right? Is correct, that we want to be careful because a large portion of that, or at least a significant portion, is hydro, which you could argue is the original renewable clean energy and goes back hundreds of years or 100 years. But the real story is around solar and wind and what's happened over the last, you know, two decades plus here. And so what we've seen is a massive decrease in the cost of producing solar wind to the point right now in many applications, if not most applications, solar and wind are actually the low cost technology for generating electricity, which I think is a story that is getting out there, but is not fully appreciated at this point. And so as a result, if you look in the United States, when we look at new generation coming online, just this past year, wind and solar accounted for 41% and 36% of new capacity being generated here. And that's interesting because just a couple years ago, natural gas-fired capacity was a significant source of new energy capacity on the grid in the U.S., and that's beginning to shrink and being basically replaced by solar and wind. So this has been this transformational story over the last couple decades, but we're not there yet. In fact, we've got a long way to go, and there are significant barriers that we need to talk about before this transition hopefully takes place.
And so before we dive into some of the challenges, which I'm keen to ask you about, can you just play it out for us? So for those of our listeners who are curious about this clean energy and maybe they know more or less about it, like how does this affect our day-to-day lives? Like if you think about me at home or us coming in to work every day at Darden, what is the difference that we will see or eventually maybe hope to see if we all embrace and start to use solar or wind-generated electricity?
So it's interesting. You think about the output. This is electricity. Most of us have no sense of where our electricity comes from, how it's generated. Historically, again, there are sources like hydro. There are sources like coal, which has been a huge generator historically for electricity. A little bit of oil, but not as much as you might think. Oil is obviously used for transportation and other uses, but not necessarily for electrical production in high volume these days. But then natural gas is being another. And of course, nuclear as another that's been around for at least a half century now. And so for the average consumer, you probably don't know how your electricity is produced. What's exciting about the trajectories we're on, I think there's a future where we could be looking at incredibly low-cost energy, low-cost electricity.
So my monthly bill to the electric company will go down.
It could go down. That's an exciting future, and really a future that we've been living the past century. And you could, lots of arguments that some of the economic growth we've seen has been because of the reduction in energy costs that we've seen, and that this might be the next step in achieving those reductions.
And do you see that change occurring at our homes? Will I suddenly have many more solar panels? I grew up in a warmer country where it was obvious that we all had our own solar panels. Here, you don't see it as frequently in the U.S. Is the change going to occur at the micro individual homeowner? Will I just start to put a wind turbine at home? Or is this something that you expect to see more at the electricity company level?
Yeah, you're probably not going to see a wind turbine, maybe a wind turbine at home, but probably more likely solar panels on your home. So this is a whole question of utility scale renewables, solar and wind, versus what we would call distributed renewables. So this would be solar panels on your home or on the local Walmart's roof and the like there. My personal opinion is I think if we're eventually going to truly decarbonize the sector, we'll probably have to have distributed sources. We're going to have solar panels on homes and the like. And there's a number of reasons to do that. Can I geek out for
yes,
a little
please,
bit here?
Yes, please, go okay. for it. This is
so,
your moment.
Here are one of the big challenges, which is intermittency. So this is the notion, very simply, that the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. When it comes to solar, very obviously, energy is only produced when the sun is out, so just during the course of the day, not in the evenings and the like. Wind, also variable for a variety of reasons. It varies not only on the day-to-day, but also season to season. So this time of year in the Northern Hemisphere, we're in the winter, solar production is going to be less than it is in the summertime when the sun's beating down, you know, more directly.
And ironically, we need the energy and electricity even more because it's darker and it's colder and during the day.
And you just hit upon the other part of this, which is the demand side. Demand for electricity varies quite a bit over the course of the day and over the course of the year. You know, there's certain parts of the day, like in the middle of the night where we don't have much going on, you know, 7 p.m., we're all coming home from work and we're turning on those, you know, TVs and our lights and more importantly, running our washer and dryer and things that consume a lot of electricity. And so the demand for electricity is varying over time. So in a world without renewables, without solar and wind, the way we've generally handled that is what we call baseload. There's some just basic level of electricity. There's a variety of things that produce that very well. Nuclear is a great example. But then you need variable loads to meet that varying variable demand. And so gas generators are useful for kind of ramping up and ramping down to meet the demand in the moment. So you don't have that option per se with solar and wind. But what you do have is the opportunity to think about storage. And so another important piece of this whole puzzle is going to be maybe battery storage or other forms of storage of electricity that allows you to deploy it when needed. And what's exciting is as we start to electrify things like vehicles, we can then schedule when we then charge our cars to kind of levelize and flatten some of that load that we have and to make this whole system work better and more efficiently here. So this is why I think, you know, we need absolutely a massive amounts of utility scale solar and wind. But there's a future in which distributed will also help because, again, you might have an electric vehicle in the driveway, solar panels on your roof, a battery in your home, and you're charging when demand is low and you're, you know, taking electricity, obviously, when demand is high. So this is the future, I think, that people have envisioned. And we're slowly making progress to that kind of integrated distributed future.
In one way, it's describing a future. And in another way, it reminds me a little bit of the past. So if I think about right now how I have water in my house, I have my own well. So I have an ability to store water when the water comes, and then I can use it all year round, those of us who have houses on well. And again, this sounds a little bit old-fashioned, I'm going to go to the well, but really the system is pretty sophisticated. It does require some energy there and electricity, but in a that's what you're describing in a similar way, the way that I'm going to consume my electricity using my own resources and my ability to store it for when I need it.
That's right. And actually, it's funny you should mention that because there is a technology around hydro pumps where you use solar and wind when it's in excess of the demand on the grid to pump water back up to the beginning of a dam, and then you can use and release that water to produce electricity when you need it. And it's, in essence, a giant battery. So you can create giant batteries kind of powered by solar and wind using hydro as the source, ultimately, of producing electricity when you need it.
So you mentioned barriers before. And so while I thought that this disruption might be behind us already, you're saying there are still some barriers to making it the main source of energy and the main source of electricity produced worldwide. We know that across the globe, not all countries are marching at the same beat for various reasons. So tell us a little bit about the challenges and the barriers.
Yeah, so US is now number two in electrical production in the world. Number one, China. Yeah. Number three, India. We'll see if they continue to be growing economies, but they are, you know, at least the last couple decades have, especially China, been significantly growing economies, which puts more demand on electricity. And they've been building out significant new electrical generations in China. What's interesting is they're the world's leader now in installed renewables and solar and wind. But you know what? They're still building coal-fired power plants because they have that much increased demand. Now, again, fascinating state of the world right now on where China is moving in the future. And will we still see that significant level of growth? Are we seeing a shift in China's position in the world and especially those growth prospects? But again, if we're going to decarbonize, it's not what the U.S. does. It's what these other countries do as well.
And so what are some things that are preventing them from investing all of their growth in renewables?
Yeah, well, again, I mentioned the intermittency problem and the need for storage that goes along with that. But you think about just the significant capital investments to build out solar fields and wind farms, and we can talk about offshore wind and the like. This is a massive capital investment that needs to take place. And it's not easy, right? You know, it's not easy to find where to site these and to get communities to agree and go through the regulatory barriers. I was reading one recently about Europe and just the amount of time it takes in Europe to get something done. You think it's bad in the US, like their regulatory barriers, you know, arguably are even worse. And so this all takes time. And it's not just the, you know, building of a solar field. It's also the electrical generation to connect, because you need high-powered electrical lines to connect these sources together. Arguably, we're moving from a world in which we have in the U.S., you know, a few thousand generation sources in terms of coal, fire plants, and natural gas and the like, and nuclear, to now having, you know, thousands and thousands, if not, you know, if we go to distributed, millions of sources of electrical generation. That puts a lot of demands on the grid. So another thing we need is advances and investments in smart grid, the technology that allows you to trade electrons. Pricing, there's a whole business part of this, dynamically pricing electricity as, you know, again, demand is varying over the course of the day. These are all significant investments that need to occur. And whether we have the will and the time, I think, is what's most important here to pull this off when we need to.
It reminds me a little bit of what we talked about earlier with EVs, and the barriers there are also infrastructure based, yeah. Right? When we have a network, when we have places to charge our cars, when everything is connected in a way that is easy to plug and play, we will see everything ramp up in terms of usage.
Yeah. But this is where I think markets are fascinating. And as we talked about with EVs, I do think things like charging technology is the market's coming in and providing that there. This is a little different in that utilities are, you know, kind of natural monopolies. They have heavy state involvement, and it adds additional layers of complexity here. It's not like you can just go out and build a solar, you know, array and then you're done. It's like, no, then you have to work with the whole regulatory apparatus to plug in to the grid and be part of this electrical system that we have. And so in many ways, there's just even more barriers to kind of building out what we need than we see in the EV charging world.
Because we're relying more on large companies and corporations and not necessarily on the individual consumers to play it out.
Maybe. I mean, in some ways, I could argue that might make it easier. But again, it's that regulatory environment. And, okay. You know, who sets price, right? This isn't a completely open market. There are regulators who actually set prices in electrical markets. So you have to deal with those. And so these are the complexities in the electrical generation sector that we don't see in a lot of other sectors.
And is it surely the authorities and the regulators also have incentive to move to a world with clean energy, or at least we would like to think that they do? What would be some barriers at their level? Is it political? Are we going to end up talking about the political tension here?
I think it is political. I mean, I think there's also reliability is very important on our grid, and not, you know, that's very important. And then cost, right? And so, again, if the cost of the electricity produced in this integrated system is going to be incredibly low, but you've got to have a huge fixed cost. So it's a classic high fixed cost, low variable cost versus fossil fuels, where they're also still a high capital expenditure, but there's also the fuel cost, right? So the nice thing is, you know, the wind and the sun don't cost anything.
Right.
So the fuel costs are high, but those are deferred, right? They're not all assumed upfront. And so as a result, you know, there's challenges of like who pays when, right? Do you charge all your customers now for a significant capital investment that, you know, will have even a positive ROI? How do you spread that out? These are all the questions that, you know, the regulators and the like have to deal with.
So it's a cash flow problem.
It's a
cash flow problem, yeah. Which is fascinating from a business perspective.
Yeah.
Tell me if more barriers or, you know, we're going to conclude today, good disruption, bad disruption, or no disruption.
Yeah.
Folks that are thinking about bad disruption, what is on their mind? Are there side effects that we're not talking about? And I'm going to be pushing you because I know that you're a big fan, you know, in favor.
You might know
of
what my answer is going to be already. Yeah, I mean, I think one that you hear a lot about actually from an environmental standpoint is the build out of these technologies, especially solar to some extent, but especially batteries. There's nasty stuff, and you've got to mine. You've got to mine for rare earth minerals and the like, and those are going to create other environmental challenges, arguably, here. There's definitely worries about the supply chain, whether we have sufficient production.
What about equity and access?
Exactly. And I think there's, like I said, geopolitical. So some of the pieces of the supply chain are dominated, for example, by China. Lithium is actually an abundant resource kind of spread throughout the world. There's lots of opportunities for mining lithium. Lithium production to put into batteries is like owned by China right now. And so there's parts of that supply chain that reside in certain locations. And there are obviously those who are concerned what that means from a geopolitical risk standpoint. If we look at the Inflation Reduction Act that came out of the United States, a lot of the incentives require production basically not in China. And so they're trying to incentivize other markets to build out the supply chain for this. And at one level, I'm optimistic because I think this is where markets are so powerful. When you get the incentives aligned, the markets will come in. But time again, right? It's going to take some time. You don't just stand up a mine to mine rare earth metals overnight. And time is of the essence here.
And it's interesting because we're seeing this play out when it comes to oil and gas companies around the world.
Yeah.
Everything from the war right now in Europe between Ukraine and Russia, and just in general for generations, the power focals around the world that had to do with producing gas and oil played out interestingly on the progression of the field in general.
No, and I think this is, again, one of those complexities. I'm actually doing some, and I won't geek out on this, but some modeling work right now on learning curves. And we talk about what we call contemporaneous uncertainty, which is just academic speak for variability in prices that we see in input factors, right? So the fact that like Russia invades Ukraine and natural gas prices and oil prices skyrocket as a result, well, that affects your choice of whether you build a natural gas plant or a renewable plant, right? And in many ways, that variability ultimately might actually incentivize some of this because companies and supply chains are looking like resilience is going to become important here. And we don't want to be subject to this variability that we see in fossil fuel markets. Solar and wind are pretty predictable once you kind of build them out, like what's it going to cost to continue to produce. So there's some risk aversion here that's driving towards renewables as well, which again is a positive if you think this is a good transition.
It's still going to depend geographically to some degree on where you are around the globe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, look, I think we've pretty much exhausted all of my knowledge here. I think it's time to bring in an expert.
I'm sure that there was more there if I dug in deeper.
No, I think, again, I've probably misspoken about 100 things already, but it is time to bring in an expert. And we're really, really excited to have Sandy Reske with us. Sandy is a true pioneer in this field. He started Greenlight Power back in 2000, a wind company, utility scale wind company. He sold that to BP Alternative Energy in 2006, turned right around and started another renewable energy company, Apex Clean Energy. Apex plays now in a variety of different spaces, wind, solar, also batteries, and also kind of hydrogen and clean fuel production, which we could geek out on. There's a whole bunch of things that this becomes really important for industrial uses, air travel and the like, potentially here. So Sandy, thank you so much for joining us here. And maybe to kick things off, can you just tell us a little bit of how you got started in 2000? Because that wasn't a time where this was, I would argue, a hot industry. So what led you to start, in this renewable energy space?
Getting started in the clean energy sector in 2000, really for me, it was a career pivot. I was interested in sort of aligning my values and the ambition to have sort of an impact in my career. I was looking at sort of pollution in Eastern Europe. I'd been working in Eastern Europe for a couple of years, and you can see the pollution on the ground. The snow is brown to black sometimes, and so it was sort of a personal journey to come to the conclusion that wouldn't it be great to work in clean energy in some aspect. And I looked at solar, and it was just way too expensive. But when I looked at wind power, even then in 2000, it was right on the cusp of being cost competitive, and I could see that it wouldn't be long before this would be a new source of energy, and wouldn't that be an exciting industry to be a part of. And that's kind of how I got started.
So here we are now, 20 plus years later. How have things changed? And we've talked a little bit about the kind of phenomenal story and the reduction of costs and the growth. But in, from your perspective, you know, how has the world changed in this 20 plus years?
Well, a couple of statistics for you. This year, last year, 2022, we got more power from renewables, that's wind and solar and hydro, than coal. So, you know, 20 years ago, coal supplied about half of our electricity, and it's now gone down so sharply, and renewables have been growing so quickly that we've sort of hit a very big milestone there. I think another one I'll share with you is that there is a real stampede to clean energy. If you look at the grid applications, so if you're going to build a new power plant, you have to apply to get on the transmission grid. And that's a very expensive process. It could be $200,000 just to get the application in and pay the fee, and then millions of dollars over time, perhaps 2 or 3 years, sometimes more, to hold your spot in the queue to be able to connect at a specified time once all the studies have been done and the costs are known. And the engineering has been done. So the people spending money to build new power plants who are in the queue are serious. They're putting serious risk dollars to work. And if you look at fossil fuel, it's a total story of capitulation, right? So there's nobody in the queue for coal or nuclear. And then natural gas has been dropping, just a sharp down and to the right over the past, this is the past 5 years. But you look at wind and solar and batteries, and they are just extreme curves, almost vertical. And they comprise probably 90% of the applications to get onto the grid. And the reason this is important is this is like a crystal ball. Like the new energy that comes into this onto the grid in this country can be found in these queue positions, and it's all clean. I mean, there is some natural gas still, but it's shrinking. So
I think that's positive. I mean, that sounds encouraging.
Well, I'm going to ask Yael's question to me, which is like, is this done? It's like, should we not be talking about disruption because it's done? Is this happening, or is it a little premature to declare victory at this point?
Very premature. We still only have about 15% of the market for solar and wind as far as electricity generated. And, you know, we need to get up to 90%, 100% eventually, you know, with storage. And so there's a lot of paths to get there. And I'm very, very confident in where wind and solar are today and how cheap they are. They're just getting more and more cost competitive. But there are also technologies like geothermal, which have found essentially better ways to capture the energy in the Earth's crust through technologies that are borrowed from the oil and gas sector. So drilling technologies have gotten more accurate. They can go deeper for less money, and they also can aim and direct their drill heads and all kinds of technologies that were very important for the fossil fuel sector now are migrating, and they are factors for geothermal. So that is a baseload resource. So that's very exciting addition, clean energy addition to the mix.
So repurposing equipment and capabilities sounds excellent, because that means less waste. But still, I feel like there are skeptics out there. Like, what can you tell us, where are the skeptics coming from, and how should we be thinking about the critique?
Well, I think we should think about it in the context of what our alternatives are. In other words, if we're going to be critical about, and we should try to improve, on an ongoing basis in any way we can. But there are, every source of energy has drawbacks. And, in the scheme of things, I think the profile for clean energy is extraordinarily good. The payback times, not just for how quickly you get paid back for your money, but the energy you put in and how quickly you recover that and the carbon used to produce it and how quickly, you know, it's for solar and wind, the numbers are like under 36 months, you know, 2 years, 18 months. It really depends whether you're producing in the Sahara Desert where you get so much more resource or whether you're in a place like Maine, the payback will be slower in a place like Maine, but it's still, you still are overcoming all of the burdens that you've put yourself through to get those installations up and running, whether it's money spent or energy spent or carbon emissions. All of those are quickly recovered, and that's wildly unusual. It's actually a bit of a miracle.
You know, we talk a lot about S-curves on this podcast. Yeah, yeah. And technology S-curves. And I do think it's hard often for people to fully appreciate what they mean and how that you can get to these dramatic improvement cycles that can just, again, radically change the economics here. I'm curious, is something we touched upon just briefly around the Inflation Reduction Act, but more broadly, kind of changing geopolitical tendencies towards supply chains, in particular China in the U.S. As a business person in this space, who I imagine a lot of the solar panels you purchase probably come from China, what are your thinkings about the trade issues that are starting to play out here? Is this going to be a huge barrier to adoption, or is this not going to make a big difference at the end of the day?
It's a bit of both. In the near term, it's absolutely been problematic, and markets are still nascent in the scheme of things. You know, these are emerging industries compared to the incumbent industries. And you can look back at the fossil fuel sector, generally speaking, and there's a history of these types of concerns, real concerns about supply and the cost of fossil fuels. And those types of things are definitely playing out in wind and solar and other types of raw materials or actual products coming from other places, tariffs and that type of thing. But the economic gravity here is so strong that, to your point, over the longer term, these things work themselves out. Suppliers start building supply chains that are more reliable because there's an economic, there's real opportunity there. And the scale of this build out, I think Bloomberg recently has put the number now for between now and 2050 at around $200 trillion because we're really swapping out our entire energy infrastructure. Yeah. And it's not just electricity, you know, all the cars and all the transportation and, you know, all the heat and power for industry, all the residential heat and power and electricity, all of that needs to be powered now from clean energy. And that's, they're going to be, it's going to be decades of build out and lots of jobs created and opportunity.
We are now in 2023. It is now 2023. And so,
yeah.
We've talked a lot in this, in our previous episodes of Good Disruption around the effect of the pandemic. It has definitely impacted many of the, you know, emerging technologies and the disruptions that we've seen. Has this industry been affected by it? People at home, changes in habits, relationships around the globe. Have you seen any impact from the pandemic?
Absolutely. I think that, of course, I'm in the power sector. We are supplying bulk wholesale power to the grid, and many other companies like us. And there were definitely impacts as people shifted, lifestyles basically. But the growth in the industry actually did not stop. So I would say at that side, there was from that perspective, very much of a the trends just kept driving forward. The markets kept driving forward. But on the consumption side, so consumers, I think, were at home for over a year in most cases. And, there's a new, just a whole host of new energy products that are more convenient and cost less and deliver more value and perform better. And I believe that the types of questions we were all asking ourselves about resilience, with such an odd environment of the pandemic, people really had the chance to explore. And so sales of solar panels, for example, for the resiliency standpoint and many other standpoints, were higher. Batteries, that type of thing. So home batteries that store the solar energy so you can use the solar at night or, charge your car with it, that type of thing. Those are all, have been growing quickly and through the pandemic.
Yeah, I recently actually adopted solar panels and a wall battery at my home, and I could justify it to my wife mainly for the resiliency piece, and because the alternative would have been to buy a natural gas generator or propane generator, and that had an expense associated with it too. So we decided if we're going to make the big jump, let's do it with the clean option.
I won't tell you what I bought.
actually, while we're on that topic, Sandy, I know your work has really been on the utility scale, but I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the distributed side, distributed home solar and the like? How does that fit in the puzzle, do you think?
I think it's there's a very big barrier right now with consumer understanding of the energy transition generally, and it's going to change quickly, right? So all change sort of seems to happen slowly, like molasses, and then all at once. And I think we're approaching the second half of that. So there is an opportunity here for consumers to be really empowered to make choices that they never had before, right? So if I was a person concerned about clean energy, 10 years ago, there's no option to ask your utility for it or, get Congress to pass a bill or anything. Consumers just didn't have those choices. And today, as you all know, of course, starting with electric cars, so much more convenience. You don't have to tank them up. You never go to a gas station anymore. They perform so much better. You save money on operating costs. And you can kind of go from there, right? The next big energy asset that people can buy is solar panels, and then they're driving on sunshine. They're charging their own car at home with their own energy. So it becomes a story about like local energy. It's I get my tomatoes from the garden, I get my water from the well, and I get my energy from the roof. That is really powerful. And so you're in a place now where I see local energy being a choice that consumers have where people are putting very attractive products in front of them and consumers can opt to buy them and save money, but really get the valuable things, like you said, resiliency and, return on investment, actually payback. There's new functionality. For example, you can, with a new Ford F-150 Lightning, you can charge your house from, between 3 to 10 days, depending on how big your house is, how much energy user you are. But these cars have very, very large batteries on them. And you could see a scenario where in a power outage in a neighborhood or something, you might use your own solar panels for a while, and you might use your own batteries, but if it's cloudy for a week and your solar panels and batteries aren't keeping up, you can drive your Ford to a charging station in town, charge up and come back and keep your house running until it gets sunny again. And so the added functionality, it's kind of like going from a landline to a cell phone, so much more functionality. The people developing these technologies are full of good ideas, including, I'll just mention one more, the concept of a virtual power plant. People who have made these investments can actually get paid by the grid for being responsive to what the grid needs. So for example, if it's a very high usage day and the grid needs more power and it needs, so power plants are turning on and it's the power grid is straining to keep up, they can also send an electronic signal that automatically for people that are hooked up this way will be able to modify how your car is charging, maybe slow down the charging or just stop it for an hour or two, or whether your water heater is running or whether your thermostat is at full blast. So these are called distributed energy resources. And so as investors, consumers are investors in energy assets. Then they have basically many power plants, and across a community or a city, or you know, you can make a huge contribution to grid stability if you can manage these micro assets. So it's a fascinating world. It's still all unfolding. The business models, all of that, still coming together, but definitely worth watching.
You know, one of the things that resonates with what you're saying is, and something we argued with electric vehicles, is this idea that these are cool technology. There's a lot of part of the value proposition that you could argue you don't even have to care about the environment. You don't have to care about climate change. Like, it's just a cool device. And you're kind of saying the same thing here with you know, energy production now, right? Like, this is, hey, I want to be on the technology forefront here. I should be having these types of systems in my homes. And that could be a sell point in and of itself for this, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. And so, Mike, I think you've used the word geek out several times in this conversation. So all of those who like new technologies and new innovation, I think that's part of the attraction to folks, in the sense that it seems like it's just creating really new devices that we can be inspired by, new designs, new aesthetics, a lot of different factors that that are pleasing to many people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, is it time, Yael, to make our final verdicts here?
Of course. I'm not sure how we can say bad.
Oh, wait, Sandy, you have any addition here before we wrap up?
I think there's one thing I wanted to be sure to mention,
sure.
if you're talking about disruptive or not, and that is the concept that companies like Apex that produce power at scale from wind and solar in the past have had the constraints of transmission lines, and the customers are mostly utilities. There's some corporate purchasing as well, but they've been limited where they can go with those electrons. I mean, they travel at the speed of light, and that's a plus, but they are in a regulated and monopoly market, as you pointed out. And what's profound now, what's really exciting, is that people are producing fuels from electricity, hydrogen in particular, which can then be used to make as a precursor for ammonia, fertilizer, and all kinds of things. But hydrogen fuel is a new path to market, and it's unregulated market with free market prices, a global market, a commodity, you know, global commodity, and so the new thing here is that there's a convergence of the power industry, so electricity, with the fuel industry. Mm. And it's creating essentially a whole new category of energy company. Mm-hmm. And I haven't thought of the name for that yet, but that's I find that wildly disruptive, because you then have a choice to sell to the grid or to produce hydrogen. And that's, that'll change everything.
I think that's a topic fantastic. For another podcast.
Yes,
but I would highlight, I think what's so important, and it resonates with me as a systems engineer at heart, is that system integration piece. And in the decarbonization challenge that I started with, there are these certain sectors, industrials, air travel, and the like, that electrification might not be an option. And so hydrogen is the, you know, potentially the fuel of the future.
I mean, we've seen transformation in other industries, like, you know, how we have internet in our houses. Like, we've seen how the entire approach and the big players change within a few decades because of the way that we consume it and the way that it gets delivered. So
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Huge impact.
So I'm going to give you my verdict first.
Okay, go for it.
You're
yes.
Shocked.
No
this shock. Drum roll.
No, right. We can, nobody can anticipate.
This is a good disruption. Yes. This is a good disruption. Yeah, we need this. It is happening. So I think it's not a no disruption. And it's just really exciting. It's exciting not only from the societal standpoint, but as Sandy was saying, from a business standpoint. Like, this is fundamentally changing business models, business opportunities. There's going to be a ton of money made in the, there already is, and there's going to be further opportunities here. So for those of you business, you know, inclined there, this is the new, like jump on this because this is happening. And again, it's not just the production side. It's all the subsidiary things that, latch into this that I think is really exciting.
Yeah, and I tend to agree that it's a good disruption. Arguably, it's already happening. And with all the investment and all the money and all the proven technology there, I think that it's already playing out, as we heard. So some of this has already occurred, and it will continue to maybe play out in reality. But the disruption has, in my mind, already kind of taken place. I do think that there's going to be things that we're going to have to keep our eye on. There's going to be, we need scientists to study some of the effects and some of the environmental concerns that we haven't identified yet, to be ready for the next wave, for sure, whatever that is. As with all new technology and new way of living, there's going to be other opportunities to invest and continue to improve. So it's not without hesitation.
And I think that's, and I totally agree. I think that's the history of technology, and it's very hard to avoid altogether. You know, I think when we talked to electric vehicles, I mentioned that the automobile, the internal combustion engine, was viewed as an environmental good because it was replacing horses and the manure they produced. Similarly, even the adoption of coal for the production of, you know, number of things was replacing, in some cases, biomass, like cutting down trees, which also had a huge environmental impact. So I think you're right. We have to keep our eye on the, you know, the impacts these new technologies will have. But that's, you know, that's a subject for a future in 100 years.
That's our kids' problem.
That's our kids' podcast that they're going to have to deal with. Well, Yael, as always, a joy to talk with you about these topics. Again, thank you so much, Sandy, for your time and participating with us. As always, thank you to Gary, our producer, to Becky, our chief researcher, and of course, Mark Wahlberg for all the ways he supports our podcast. Thank you all.
Good Disruption is a podcast from the University of Virginia Darden School of Business.